Welcome back to Ward Calls. Today we've got Ivor Popovich, who's going to come and talk to us about how you can use evidence-based medicine as a house officer on the ward.
Thanks, Sam. As mentioned, my name's Ivor. Unlike your kind of previous guests, I'm just a PGY3, so I don't claim to be kind of an expert on anything. But I guess I'm a guy who's kind of quite interested in evidence-based medicine, and I run a blog looking at a few evidence-based topics and how they can help you on your ward calls.
What's the blog called?
So the blog is Intern Suppository.
And we'll put a link to that in the show notes.
But if you're wondering what the name is about, it's kind of a play on the idea of being a repository of evidence-based medicine, and also, of course, a suppository. It's kind of funny at the time, but...
No, it's a good read. I highly recommend it. So yeah, look out for the link.
I'll just kind of talk about my opinion on how I think, you know, evidence-based medicine can be helpful. Because I think there's often this kind of notion when you start out practicing medicine, and evidence-based medicine seems kind of like something that's a bit esoteric for you. You often hear people talking, you know, the kind of topics that are brought up are like, you know, is this surgery better done open or laparoscopically, or does this drug improve 5-year mortality or 10-year mortality or whatever? And obviously it seems very important, but, you know, for you, you're kind of like, well, how is that actually relevant to what I'm doing every day on the wards? And I think there is actually a lot of really relevant and interesting stuff out there if you just kind of take the time to look for it and read about it. And I guess kind of the way to think about it is, if you think about what the main job you do on ward calls is, you could kind of, you know, do a whole variety of jobs, but if I were to summarize it in one sentence, I'd kind of say that the main thrust of what you're doing is trying to pick out the patients who are deteriorating and who need further intervention, and trying to separate out those guys out from the ones who are just fine and just need a bit of TLC. Don't know, would you agree with that kind of summary of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think another big job of house officers, like on the ward round and things, is to kind of pick up where the gaps are, and also, I guess, make all the decisions that haven't been decided on the ward round and by seniors, which actually ends up being a lot of patients' care.
Mm. And I guess when you're kind of in the process of doing that, in order to achieve that, you've got your kind of a toolbox of things you can use, and your toolbox is essentially your history, your examination, and your tests. And I think where you can often run into problems is where you take, you know, there's sort of an aspect of one of those, say an aspect of your history and an aspect of your test, where you put kind of too much weight on that finding, or conversely, you don't put enough weight on it. So I'll give you kind of an example to illustrate what I mean. If you think about, say, a consultant surgeon who has maybe 20, 30 years of experience, and they're assessing someone with suspected appendicitis, they've got kind of, you know, that whole 20, 30 years of experience of looking back on things that went well, things, it's the times when they stuffed up. And they kind of, it's quite actually quite a complex thought process going on in terms of assigning different weights to each aspect of the findings of the history, and deciding how much emphasis to put on certain things, and then coming to your kind of impression. And I guess when you're just starting out on the wards and you don't have that kind of experience to fall back on, so there is sometimes a tendency for oversimplifications to occur. So for example, one thing I've been told, and I'm sure many other people have heard before from other people, is this idea: you go to see someone with appendicitis and you find them sitting up in bed eating a sandwich. They kind of say, well, that person doesn't have appendicitis. But we know from looking at the literature that that's not really correct at all. If you look at the JAMA did quite an interesting series. It's called the Rational Clinical Exam Series, and they looked at kind of what the positive and negative likelihood ratios were of various history findings and examination findings. And if you look at the value of anorexia and appendicitis, it actually doesn't significantly change your pretest probability at all. If just taken in isolation, just looking at that, I mean, your chances of having appendicitis, even if you're sitting up eating a sandwich in bed, is still pretty much the same. I think that's kind of an illustration of where evidence-based medicine can help you decide what kind of weights to assign to different aspects of your toolbox, and help you pick out the right tools for the job, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, so I think kind of what you're mentioning there, like the positive, the likelihood ratio is based on specific clinical signs and symptoms that are always quite depressing when you read them in detail, because often you want to say, which ones are actually relevant, which ones are irrelevant, and very rarely will you find really solid signs and symptoms. And you always have to put the whole picture together. And yeah, you mentioned the pretest probability. What are they in the hospital for the first place? What was their presenting complaint? Is appendicitis actually the most likely to begin with? And if it is, then it shouldn't need as many things to support that diagnosis. Mm. It's also going to be harder to exclude based on, you know, signs and symptoms that aren't that good for ruling in and ruling out. The same thing applies for chest pain. There's that classic symptom set, but almost nobody has that. And unfortunately, you can never rule it in or out with just one sign or symptom.
Mm. Yeah, and I think you had a previous podcast on chest pain, and there was, you listed kind of all the different, you know, likelihood ratio. And interestingly, pain going to the right arm was actually more specific.
Yeah, sometimes it's different to what you'd expect. Yeah. And I think part of the beauty of experience is that once you've actually seen this stuff for 30 years, you don't have to remember these numbers. You actually just, it will just click. Hmm. And we can look forward to that. But in the meantime,
some kind of source to help you decide what is, you know, to make sure you don't overemphasize certain things and also make sure you don't, you know, underemphasize certain things that might be quite important. So I guess someone listening at home is hopefully kind of agree with the premise, but you're kind of thinking, well, what are some practical examples of, you know, what are some specific things that might help me out on when I'm on ward calls? And that's kind of what my blog, kind of every post is dedicated to, looking at a certain aspect of those things and going through it. But I guess I thought I'd just run through three of kind of what I find probably some of the more interesting ones, and there'll be some practical examples. So the first one, if you imagine you're called to someone on the ward who's got, they've started vomiting, they're chucking up a lot, they've got a distended belly, they're not passing any flatus, they haven't passed any flatus for the last 24 hours, you're rightly suspecting a small bowel obstruction. So you go on, you get that plain abdominal film, and much to your surprise, you find actually the film is normal. You don't see any distended loops of bowel. So you think to yourself, all right, well, I guess it must be something else. I guess they're not obstructed. And it's certainly something, a conclusion I've jumped to before, kind of without giving it much extra thought. You know, they're not obstructed on the x-ray. They're not obstructed. I have to think, you know, find something else. When you actually look at the some of the literature that's been published about the sensitivity of plain films, or plain abdominal x-rays and bowel obstruction, I mean, there's about three or four different studies, I think, and the sensitivity range is somewhere between, the range of sensitivities is between 69 and 82%. And it depends a little bit on who's reading the films, whether it's a registrar or a consultant radiologist.
And that's 3 to 4 in 5. So it's not that uncommon that it's not going to help you.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, even if we take the top number of 82%, that's good sensitivity, but it's, you know, still a significant proportion of people who might have an obstruction who the plane, you know, you'll be led astray if you just count on the abdominal, on the,
yeah,
the plane x-ray.
You'd easily miss 1 in 5 probably on a 3-month run in Genzo.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what kind of, you know, the idea that it's important about your pre-test probability, your clinical suspicion. If your clinical suspicion of someone being obstructed is high, that needs to remain high, you know, even if you've got normal imaging. And, you know, I guess that's a area where if you didn't, you know, when you don't have that experience, actually reading that kind of literature can help you avoid making that kind of error in judgment. There's a few other interesting things that come out when you look at those same studies that looked at the sensitivities. One of them is this description of something called the gasless bowel obstruction. So actually sometimes, you know, what we often look for, we're looking for distended loops of bowel, which are distended with gas. But often early on in the picture, you can get just loops of bowel that are distended purely with fluid. And actually what you might get on imaging is the opposite. So you get a featureless x-ray, you get an abdominal x-ray without any gas seen at all. And if you look closer, you can sometimes see the kind of, these thick loops of bowel that are distended with fluid.
Yeah, in textbooks, that's sometimes called paucity of gas. Or
exactly,
lack of gas.
Yeah. And that's not something I've kind of ever heard about from anyone before until I read about it in these papers. And, you know, that's something, you know, like we said, building on kind of giving you a chance to think about things or know about things that you wouldn't necessarily get a chance to maybe in doing 6 months, you know, of house officering so far to actually experience. Perhaps one of the more interesting things I found reading these studies was, so often you get a report of the abdominal film, and the report will say there's a non-specific bowel gas pattern. When you read that, what do you interpret that to mean?
Non-specific
bowel gas pattern.
Yeah,
you
see
that all the time. What does that mean to you?
It's open to your own interpretation, probably. So it just goes with whatever you think's going on, I suppose.
Well, exactly, yeah. So, I mean, I always interpreted that to mean it's kind of just a normal x-ray, you know, non-specific, normal, what you'd normally see. Turns out they did a survey of radiologists and to try and nut down exactly what they meant. Most of them do mean it to use that, but there's a not insignificant proportion who use the term to mean, I'm not sure if it's an abnormal or a normal x-ray. And there's even a non-insignificant portion of radiologists who use it to mean, it's abnormal, but I'm not sure if it's ileus or mechanical obstruction. So, I mean, next time you see that in a report, what does that, you know, what does that really mean?
Yeah, and I suppose that's exactly why you need to look at the images yourself, which starting out is always, you know, it probably won't ever change what you're doing. Mm. But over some time, you can start to link, what's this radiologist saying with what am I seeing? And I know I've got the benefit of having seen this patient, knowing their background, knowing all these likelihoods. The radiologists are often working on one sentence or often, sometimes no information at all, and really just going from the imagery.
Yeah, so that's one example. Next thing I kind of will talk about, and I guess before I talk about this topic, I'd preface it by saying it's going to be about patients with renal failure and prescribing them fluids. And I guess the thing I just say is, you know, no matter what I'm talking about here, follow what your institutional guidelines kind of tell you, because the main thing is you want to protect yourself and you want to make sure you're doing what the hospital guidelines are telling you to do. That said, there's kind of talking about that, there's this idea kind of in patients with renal failure, you don't want to give them fluids like plasmolite, because obviously plasmolite contains 5 millimoles per liter of potassium, and people with bad kidneys, they can't excrete potassium very well, so it seems like an obvious kind of contraindication. Interestingly enough, when you actually look at, there's about 3 or 4 different studies that have been done of perioperative fluid administration in patients with end-stage renal failure who are undergoing transplantation, and the patients who were randomized to be given normal saline, they had I'm talking about pretty significantly increased rates of hyperkalemia, vastly increased rates of acidosis compared to the groups that received plasmolite or other similar fluids, like lactated Ringer's, which is one they use in America. All this is kind of related to the fact that the fluids like plasmolite, they're kind of an alkalinizing fluid. They tend to increase the pH of your blood, of your plasma, and that will tend to drive potassium into cells. Whereas take a fluid like normal saline, which contains unphysiological quantities of chloride, that tends towards producing an acidosis and can actually leads to driving K out of cells. So it's the effects of the fluids on the pH which have more of an effect on the potassium than the potassium content themselves. And even if putting that aside, even if you replace the patient's entire plasma with plasmolite, you would never get a potassium above 5 anyway. There's kind of a theoretical base to that, but also strongly supported in a few various studies. That said, I'd have to say again, whatever your particular hospital tells you to do with regard to that, you should kind of still stick to that.
Would you say that there's a benefit to prescribing plasmolite over normal saline in renal failure?
Yes, I think if you look at those studies.
So it improves the outcomes?
Yeah. Oh, well, in terms of there's reduced rates of hyperkalemia and acidosis. If you're just looking at those studies.
And do you have any comment on the use of the decision between normal saline and plasmolite in other cases, say on ward calls, in your routine fluid prescribing?
I think in other cases, I have a personal bias towards plasmolite, but I think I don't know that there's much strong evidence out there.
Yeah,
in your routine cases.
So I think my personal bias is probably towards normal saline, purely for where there is a lack of evidence to use it. I'm pretty sure it's cheaper, and that's all my rationale really is. But I think it's certainly appropriate in certain cases, and I think that's a good one where, you know, I probably would choose to use plasmolite instead of normal saline.
Then the last kind of practical example we might go through is probably going back to the say history and physical exam is kind of 95% of your diagnosis. So maybe we should go back and kind of look a little bit at that. And it's kind of to do with assessing patients with asthma. I find it quite an interesting condition because people can get quite sick quite quickly, but they also get better quite quickly. And often the main thing you're kind of wanting to ask yourself when you see someone with they've been admitted with asthma exacerbation, you're asked to review them on the ward. You want to know, is this person getting better or are they getting worse? Because it's that kind of condition where they're not getting better, they're getting worse. And one of the common things you find yourself called about is asthmatics who've become tachycardic, and especially something if you do pediatrics, you get a lot of calls about that is, you know, this kid getting a lot of salbutamol and they're getting tachycardic. And there's a tendency to kind of say, well, you know, they're getting this treatment, they're getting this beta agonist, they're tachycardic because of that. Actually, when you look at the literature that's been published, tachycardia in asthma is more attributable to the severity of the underlying condition than it is to the effect of the treatment. And a lot of that kind of idea seems to be related to back in the early days when the beta agonists they were using were quite kind of dirty. They had a lot of cross effect on beta-1 stimulation, caused a lot of tachycardia. Actually, the main beta agonists that's used these days, like Ventolin or salbutamol, it's pretty kind of clean kind of drug in terms of that, you know, cross-reactivity. And if you look at studies looking at people with severe asthma exacerbations that come into ED, You know, if they're tachycardic, their tachycardia will mainly be driven by hypoxia, be driven by the feeling of suffocation, which I've never experienced that, but it doesn't sound very nice. And it will result in quite a strong sympathetic kind of surge. And if you look at what happens to those patients' heart rates when they get intensive treatment, and some of that, you know, involves things like IV salbutamol and these other quite, you know, intensive therapies, their heart rate actually falls following the treatment as the kind of the condition is made better. But that's, you know, on the ward, you hopefully shouldn't, you shouldn't be dealing with severe asthma exacerbations by yourself, hopefully, although, you know, stuff always happens sometimes. But even if you look at milder categories, if you look at studies of people with mild asthma exacerbations, if you look at healthy volunteers that they're subjected to salbutamol, and if you look at ICU patients receiving salbutamol, there's a handful of studies done looking at what the mean increase in heart rate was with the administration of beta agonist. And the maximum mean increase in heart rate you find in those studies is like 8 beats a minute. And even in some of the studies, the mean increase in heart rate was like 3 or 4 beats a minute.
So in general, if they're tachycardic with salbutamol, they're probably going to be tachycardic even if they hadn't had it.
Well, exactly, yeah. Like, there's a small effect, obviously, but it doesn't explain away a heart rate of 120.
Yeah.
You can't explain that away.
That's still abnormal.
Yeah, that's, you know, you need to be worried that they're not actually getting better. There's a few other interesting things while we're on the topic of asthma that you find from looking at some of those studies. One is about thinking about which asthmatics arrest in the hospital. So I'm not talking about people who arrive to ED and then have an arrest in ED. We're talking about people who come in with an asthma exacerbation, get admitted, and then people who go on to have a cardiac arrest in hospital. And you'd think kind of that group would be predicted by the people who came in and had the most severe exacerbations when they're admitted. But actually, it's a lot of it is related to diurnal variation in peak flow. And the figure that was found to be predictive was a 50% variation. So if you have someone who at 3 p.m. in the afternoon has a peak flow of 600 and then at 6 o'clock in the morning, it's 200. That's a greater than 50% diurnal variation. And it's that group that has the greatest association with in-hospital cardiac arrest. And if you look at the one paper that's been done, yeah, in the time they were looking at, there was about 10 patients who had 11 arrests. So some poor soul had 2 arrests during his time there. All the patients who had those in-hospital arrests, they were all initially admitted with mild exacerbations and all initially sent to the ward. But it was that diurnal variation that really predicted who would go on to have an arrest. So I guess that's quite, if you're thinking about how it's relevant to your practice, you know, knowing that helps you to kind of, in terms of your prioritization, if you get patients about an asthmatic at 6 o'clock in the morning, helps you know a bit better how to prioritize things if you know that kind of statistic. The other thing that's worth mentioning about asthma is it's always very tempting. I always still make this mistake all the time. You know, relating the severity of the wheeze to how bad the exacerbation is. You hear a very loud wheeze and it's, you know, lasts the whole lot of the cycle and you think, oh, this is quite a bad one. But actually there's no evidence to support any correlation between the severity of the wheeze and the severity of the asthma attack. And in fact, if you have someone with very very widely patent airways, they can produce quite a loud wheeze. And on the converse side, you have someone, you know, at the extreme end of the spectrum, like you talk about the silent chest phenomenon.
Yeah, that's the one that always scares me.
They're about to die, but, you know, you won't hear any wheeze at all.
Yeah. I think I'm helped there by feeling that I've always been a fairly poor at my clinical skills. Right. I've certainly tried to auscultate hearts in patients who are alive and awake, and I can't even hear their heart. And so I will never completely rely on my auscultation skills.
No, I get that sometimes. I'm actually sometimes amazed. I've never seen any documentation of heart sounds that weren't dual. And that must be a lie, because there's so many times where I think, God, I can't hear any heart sounds.
Yeah. Like, well, sometimes you say dual plus an extra heart sound, in which case, well, not so much dual anymore, but
yeah, cool. I mean, those are the kind of three examples I thought were quite interesting that will kind of, you know, show you, the first one, you know, how not to over rely on an imaging test. Number two is about your, you know, different therapies and how actually they might benefit. And number three is about, you know, not misinterpreting the various clinical signs when it comes to asthmatics. And there's plenty more stuff like that that's out there.
No, they're great examples, and it just highlights that principle of always thinking about why you do the things you do. And if you're not sure why, then go and look for the evidence. And I think these are great things where they can change, you know, how you're going to make your clinical decisions, and you can actually say, well, I may not be able to recount the evidence, but hey, I heard it on this podcast that I should at least have a second think about this x-ray or which fluid I'm going to use, and then try to you find a justification for why you're making the decision that you're making. If you don't know why you made that decision, try and find out sometime so that you can have a bit more confidence in it, at least the next time around.
Yeah. And I mean, there's no shame in, because all these things that I have looked into and done studies are all mistakes I've made, things that, you know, we've all done. So
yeah, I always say doing this podcast series, I've learned a whole lot. So it's not to say that I go around doing this these perfect board calls myself. Yeah.
And as I said, I'm not, you know, all this stuff I'm talking about is not kind of me sitting down going, oh, this is my experience, whatever. This is, you know, I'm, as I said at the beginning, still very, very junior. But this is all just kind of stuff that's really interesting that you just, you know, that you just kind of can learn looking at papers and looking at various evidence for things.
Yeah. It's also important to point out that it doesn't make one decision right or wrong. Experience and also the clinical situation is also going to impact heavily on, you know, what the right thing to do is in the end too. But it's good general approaches. Another thing to kind of piggyback on this, it's not so much evidence-based but more consensus-based recommendations. There's a global initiative called Choosing Wisely. They've got a website, choosingwisely.org.nz, and it also runs in the US, Canada, UK, Australia, and some of Europe. And this is a group or a campaign which is aimed at reducing the use of low-value tests and interventions. So it's something that's kind of close to my heart of, I think, being a bit sensible about about your treatments and what investigations you order. And what this website lists are recommendations by generally kind of colleges and specialty medical groups, which are consensus-based recommendations on daily practice, mainly things to avoid. And I'll just run through some of the examples, which I think are really good. So the Internal Medicine Society of Australia and New Zealand, this is mainly physicians and Gen Med, their first recommendation is avoiding medication-related harm in older patients receiving 5 or more regularly used medicines by performing a complete medication review. And that sounds like really obvious, but I think it's just they've made that their number one recommendation, just to actually, wherever you see somebody who's receiving a whole bunch of medications, actually review all the medications and whether, you know, which ones are necessary and what can be changed. Do you really need to add another medication, and always consider the harm of polypharmacy when you're adding that extra medication? They've said don't request daily full blood counts or inflammatory markers like CRP or ESR for patients who are on antibiotics if they are clinically improving. And I think that's a really good point. Like, if you're going to do a blood test, it should be there to kind of change your management. And if this patient's getting better each day, what are you going to do if the white cells are slightly raised or the CRP is still going up? I think probably you'd be best to ignore it. But in that case, why did you do it in the first place? So obvious, but they've put that right up there. They think that's important, and it's because everybody makes this mistake. Their third point, once patients become afebrile on IV antibiotics, stop prescribing IV antibiotics, change them over to orals. it's great advice. And that goes on. Each of them has about 5 recommendations. The Australasian Society for Infectious Diseases, their first recommendation, don't use antibiotics in asymptomatic bacteria. So if they've got a UTI but they have no symptoms of it, you don't need to treat it. If you treat it, it will probably come back again later on, and you're really just treating numbers. Don't swab leg ulcers that aren't clinically infected. They will grow something, and you don't need to treat them. And swabs cost a lot of money, actually. They cost in the order of $20 to $70, depending on what they are. Avoid prescribing antibiotics in upper respiratory tract infection. I think that's what they've said is avoid. So there are certainly times when an upper respiratory tract infection does need treatment. But they're saying at least avoid it in general. So always consider it and say, does this patient in front of me really need these antibiotics? The New Zealand Medical Students Association, they go for some really kind of solid basic clinical pearls. Ensure that the test, treatment, or procedure is indicated and will make a difference to the course of patient care. That applies to everything we do. You know, first, do no harm. Make sure you're actually doing something that's going to be useful and is appropriate. Their second recommendation is provide an opportunity for the patient to discuss the necessity of tests, treatments, and procedures. This is actually a fundamental patient right that's often overlooked. They may not necessarily be interested, that you don't have to have a discussion, but the opportunity should exist. So you probably should discuss with them if you're going to be ordering a CT or an ultrasound or going to do extra blood tests. They have a right to be involved, and I think that patient outcomes will be improved if they're actually involved in the decision-making and what's actually happening to them. And lastly, I was just going to go over the Royal Australian College of Surgeons, their third recommendation, don't transfuse more units of blood than absolutely necessary. A lot of hospitals, I think, have a bit of a campaign about reducing the use of blood products. Certainly try to use one unit of red cells rather than two or three. Often patients improve clinically after one, and they don't usually need more than that. Likewise, a lot of patients can go without transfusion entirely and could probably just do with an iron infusion or just some fluids to begin with. But at least, yeah, be restrictive with your blood transfusion use. And so that website's really good, and it doesn't take long to actually get through pretty much all of the recommendations. So I highly recommend that one, choosingwisely.org.nz.
I think the one about asymptomatic bacteriuria is quite a good one. Essentially, because there's a lot of times you turn up to ask to review someone on the ward, you get handed over a patient by a colleague, and they say, this patient's been admitted with a UTI. And I never believe that. It's often like a lot of the time it turns out to be they've had something non-specific, which can't be attributed to UTI at all, and they've just happened to have a positive urine. And that can, like, if you anchor on that idea that they have a UTI, it can lead you quite down the wrong path.
Yeah. They probably came in with abdominal pain, but that's it. What was a presenting complaint? And unless it was, you know, stinging dysuria, keep your differential broad. Stick with a differential or a working hypothesis rather than hanging on that diagnosis of UTI. Because especially if they're then being asked to see them again, then it's almost certainly wrong. Because if they've got a UTI, they should be getting better with the antibiotics that have been prescribed. The last just kind of highlight, the thing I wanted to highlight was that the Ministry of Health has recently updated certification of death. There is now an electronic death certificate form, which is being trialled at County Manukau. It's great because it combines both the death certificate and the frustrating council cremation certificate all into one. So you don't have to enter a whole bunch of information twice. You can type, so you don't have to use your best handwriting, and you can fix little mistakes and even save it as a draft before submitting it. I haven't had the pleasure of using the entire thing for it in a real case myself, but I have had a play with it. I think it's a really great start. And the Ministry of Health has also published two new pages on their website under Medical Certificate of Cause of Death. And this just gives some more examples of how to complete the form and examples of causes of death, the times between them, and incorrect examples. And this is a nice update because the last thing that they published was from 2001 and didn't list nearly as many. So I'll link to those in the show notes. So check those out sometimes. And I think they're worth having a read through before you next have to certify death, just so that they're in the back of your mind. Well, thank you, Ivor, for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And check out the blog, The Intern Suppository. As always, bear in mind that our advice does not replace hospital policy, good clinical judgment, or your consultant's decisions.